Good afternoon. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and it's time for All Things Political. The George Zimmerman trial is over, but our national dialogue around it is not. And the political response to the trial got a jolt last week when President Obama issued his comments, which we'll hear here.
When Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is, Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago. And when you think about why, in the African-American community at least, there's a lot of pain around what happened here, I think it's important to recognize that the African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences. And a history that that doesn't go away.
We'll hear about that issue, plus much more on this hour of All Things Political. My guest this hour is Matt Grossman, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Michigan State University and author of The Not-So-Special Interests, Interest Groups, Public Representation, and American Governance. Professor Grossman, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Well, after George Zimmerman was acquitted last week in the fatal shooting of Trayvon Martin in Florida, the Justice Department is still considering whether or not to pursue federal civil rights cases against Zimmerman, and the NAACP has been pushing heavily for this lawsuit as well. Can you, first of all, help us understand the distinction between the criminal trial, which just ended, and a civil case?
I think the Justice Department would be a federal civil rights trial if it took place. The signs we're getting are not from the Justice Department and from the White House don't seem like that's very likely to take place. Also, the family, of course, could pursue wrongful death or any other kind of a trial on their own, but that wouldn't require federal intervention.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the reasons that a federal intervention doesn't seem likely is because it sounds like it would be unlikely to prove that George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin for race-based reasons. How would they have to go about effectively proving that in the first place?
I don't know the specifics, but I think the general theory as to why it's is more complicated here is that it would be an individual person, so it's not it's not analogous to the situation with Rodney King, where they were able to talk about the role of the police department as an institution and the evidence of the role of race is not quite as great as in that situation, or at least as they've judged it so far.
Mm-hmm. And Attorney General Eric Holder pledged for a full investigation of Martin's death after the acquittal last week, but he didn't promise any federal charges, of course. What would be the political fallout in either case? Can you talk a little bit about who's sort of rooting for a federal case and who's not?
Well, as you said, there's some interest groups that have voiced support for federal intervention, but I haven't necessarily seen any of them predict that it's going to happen. So I wouldn't expect them to be overly surprised if that doesn't take place. If there was a surprise and there was federal intervention in the case and some kind of a new federal trial, obviously, that would keep national attention on the case for a lot longer and could provoke a backlash among at least some people who think the case was correctly decided.
Mm-hmm. To what degree is it important that Holder and the Justice Department maintain political support, though, from either side of the aisle?
It certainly is useful for bureaucracies to have support from multiple constituencies, but the people calling for further federal action are the same people who are usually supportive of the Justice Department and President Obama. So I wouldn't say that it's necessary to maintain that constituency.
Mm-hmm. So let's say that the Justice Department does decide to go forward with something. What are the greater implications of that, maybe for Zimmerman as an individual, for the state of Florida, or even the country at large?
Well, I mean, certainly for Zimmerman, you know, you can't be tried twice for the same crime, but you can have two different trials associated with the same incident if you're charged with different things or in different court systems. So that certainly is a primary interest to him and the families involved. For you know, for Florida and the United States, obviously the debate would go on in more public forums for a longer period if there was some federal intervention or a separate follow-up a trial of any kind. But you know, I think we will continue to talk about the incident and related race relations in the U.S. Regardless of what happens on that front.
Well, it certainly sounds like it. And there's a lot of social pressure to repeal the Stand Your Ground law in Florida and other similar laws across the country. Do you think, though, that pressure will gain enough political traction?
I mean, I'm generally skeptical that sort of, you know, national calls to reform laws necessarily have a straight line towards repeals in state legislatures where those laws might have more support or at least had enough support to be enacted in the first place. So we haven't yet seen a lot of evidence that states are actually moving forward and repealing those laws, only evidence that people who were already against them are being more boisterous in their opposition to them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like a lot of your research these days is on special interests and sort of the underlying fabric beneath our political environment. Can you talk a little bit about how the Stand Your Ground law came to be?
I mean, it has a somewhat different story depending on what state, but certainly it's part of an overall effort on the part of people who are far less punitive gun laws and less gun control, and also people who feel that the sort of right to self-defense or to defend your house or possessions should be enhanced rather than be subject to some kind of regulation.
Mm-hmm. I'm Cynthia Schuster sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, and this is All Things Political. We're talking with Matt Grossman, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Michigan State University, and we're taking your calls, too. The number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can email us your questions and thoughts as well at talk@WPR.org or find us on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We are wondering, too, what's your reaction to the Justice Department's investigation into the Zimmerman trial verdict? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. We also have a couple of other topics to get to this hour as well, including the productivity of our Congress. As of July 8th, our United States Congress successfully passed just 15 bills, the fewest at this point in the year for any Congress in recent history. House Speaker John Boehner pushed back at allegations that Congress has been unproductive, saying that most Americans think we have too many laws and they want Congress to repeal more of them. I'm wondering, Matt Grossman, is this, in fact, the least productive Congress in recent history, at least statistically speaking?
Well, if you go by number of laws passed, then it certainly looks that way. There's some effort to adjust those statistics to say, well, some of the laws that we do pass are longer than some shorter bills that we've passed in previous Congresses. But pretty much any way you look at it, it looks like a very unproductive Congress and part of a recent trend from the last Congress as well. I will say my own research shows that the total level of government activity and the amount of significant legislation passed is closely correlated with how much government expands and moves policy to the left. So there is sort of a rationale in Boehner's strategy to say that he's really not for more laws, because at least in American policy history, when we get more laws, we tend to be moving policy towards the left rather than the right.
Is that true? Why is that?
I think it's just a lot more difficult to pass something that contracts something that government is already doing rather than tries to just bring on another activity of government. So the And it's also the case that you tend to have conservative enactments sometimes be big restructuring or reform efforts rather than lots of small advancements, whereas liberal policy you can often see taking place across the board in lots of different issue areas. So, you know, our most recent period was the first 2 years of the Obama administration. We had a unified Democratic government, and we had more laws passed, but we also had policy moving, you know, aggregate in the left liberal direction. So from Boehner's perspective, that is worse than no legislating at all.
Well, a lot of the, accusations from Republicans toward Democrats is that they're all for big government. And maybe one extension of that is the more government you have, then therefore the more government activity there is. What do you say to that?
Right. I think at least historically, I mean, my research covers, you know, 1945 to today. And within that time period, there's, you know, a correlation of about 0.7 between the number of significant laws that are passed and the number of significant liberal laws that are passed, whereas there's almost no correlation with the number of conservative laws that are passed. So it does appear that when government is acting quite a bit, it tends to be moving policy in a direction that Obama would favor more than Boehner.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are kind of sitting back and watching Congress not, you know, compromise, not to, appear to be straying too far from the party line. But are there other justifiable reasons for kind of churning out so few bills for the president to sign and veto?
I guess it depends on your definition of justifiable. Mm-hmm. From Boehner's perspective, the question would just be, can anything get passed that he wants to pass or that a Republican caucus would be in favor of passing? And I think right now, you know, most of the answer is no. The kinds of things that are on the president's agenda, the media's agenda, and to some extent the public's agenda are not necessarily things that the Republican caucus in the House favors. So from their perspective, they're better off with almost nothing happening than going along with the preferences of others.
Well, ironically, some people say that last year's Congress was even worse than this year's Congress. So what has this Congress done so far this year that might have scored itself some brownie points?
Not a lot. I mean, most of the stuff that's even of little significance was pretty reactionary, like they fixed a problem with the FAA to try to shorten airport lines, but that's a problem that they had previously caused with the sequester. So they really haven't done much other than correct some of the some of the flaws in what they had done before. We did have a very significant enactment at the very beginning of the year with the tax increases and the related budget negotiations, but essentially that sort of set us up for not having a much major agreement between the parties since that time.
Mm-hmm. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn this week on the Ideas Network. We're talking with Matt Grossman, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Michigan State University. And we're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Are you disappointed with what Congress has and has not been accomplishing this year? Is it still better than last year? Are they doing anything right in your mind? Let us know. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or tweet us. I'm Cynthia Schuster, and for Kathleen Dunn, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn, and this is All Things Political on Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Matt Grossman, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Michigan State University. We're taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234 and your emails at talk@wpr.org, talking about a number of things this week, including the productivity or not of our Congress, as well as the political fallout of the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman trial. And eventually we're going to get around to some political appointments to the federal government as well. Let's take some calls. We've got Jerry in Onalaska on the line. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, hi. I'm very interested in the political ramifications of the turmoil over the Trayvon Martin case. I am curious as to who is directing this and what is causing this issue to be brought to the forefront. I would think that the black community, who's had these experiences that the president mentions, would be much more excited about the, probably hundreds of deaths that have taken place since Trayvon's death, where a black man has shot a black man, killed a black man. I would think that the black community, as well as the other community, would be concerned with the 80% of the population in prisons being black, and while the population is only 13%. Are we missing the real problem? Are we talking about the right thing? And who's directing this? And why is the president participating in this?
So, Jerry, what do you think the social conversation should be around this case?
Well, I think it should be on trying to decide how we can help the black community become a more productive and positive part of society.
Okay. And Matt Grossman, what's your reaction to that?
Well, there have been some discussions of both black on black crime and African Americans' criminal justice system by many of the same leaders that are organizing the protests and marches, like National Action Network, that Al Sharpton runs or is the figurehead of. But obviously, in some sense, you go with the agenda that's at the top of the news. And in some sense, this did build up from Florida. It actually took a couple of weeks after the incident to become a national story. But at that point, it was fodder for ongoing discussions. And so these organizations are, in some sense, driving the story and keeping it going. But in another sense, they're going along with the agenda that that the media and public reaction in Florida had already developed.
And Jerry also mentioned the president getting involved or at least issuing his comments. Did he, in a way, is he overstepping his boundaries? Should he have stayed silent on the issue?
Well, it's certainly unusual and personal that the president would go out and give at least more off-the-cuff than usual remarks to the press corps, especially a president that hasn't been a regular in the press room. So certainly is unusual. The reaction in the media and among commentators seems to be, I guess, somewhat positive so far. So I wouldn't say that it's hurt him so far. But I also think we tend to overestimate the influence of presidential rhetoric. Mm-hmm. Most political scientists, although we've seen a big increase in the amount of time that the president spends talking to the public in the media, doing public events, we haven't seen much evidence that all of that increased activity is generating any real change in public opinion.
Kathy and Grafton, you're next. Hi, Kathy.
Is it me you're talking to?
It is. Could you take off your speakerphone, though?
I'm sorry. This weekend, my brother mentioned that the Trayvon Martin protests were being funded by the White House, and I was shocked, and I guess I want to know if there's any truth in that statement.
Do you know, Matt?
Not that I know of. The National Action Network was behind most of the large protests. I'm sure that Democratic and liberal donors have, may have ties to both that organization and the White House, but there's no involvement directly from the White House, although certainly Obama speaking on the issue, is a potential aggravator of public concern over it.
1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have questions or comments for all things political. We'll go next to Michelle in Milwaukee. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I just had a comment. I received a recent email. It was just an expose by Pat Buchanan about recent things in race in America. And he mentions the fact that white people in America have really been most recently at the receiving end of the racist violence. And, I guess a jury found Mr. Zimmerman not guilty, yet there are protests being made, and then the president comes in and admits that he could have been a thug. And I don't know. I just think it's I think that there is a whole different agenda in some cases. I mean, I don't think that the trial itself was about racism. It was about violence. So, I don't know. I think there are more black people dying at the hands of black people than, people defending themselves. I truly do.
Matt, I know you're a political scientist. I don't know if you have any statistics on that, but do you know if that's true?
I'm sure if you counted up every one is a victim of crime, people who were or a victim of a shooting, only a small proportion would be in an incident like this one. But certainly this one has come to arouse a public sentiment a lot more than some other incidents. Having said that, I don't necessarily think that the organizations involved are not also concerned about a general crime and certainly the black imprisonment rate that the previous caller mentioned. So those are certainly ongoing issues for these organizations, but to some extent they are taking advantage of the high level of public salience and awareness about these issues now to try to make a broader statement.
Well, and certainly the court case wasn't based on race issues, but that was just one of the layers, I guess, surrounding the situation.
Well, and in fact, it seemed that the prosecutor had made a decision to make it less about race than he could have with a different kind of legal strategy. And then the president's comments, I think we should note, didn't necessarily directly disagree with the verdict and did accept the verdict. In some sense, this is just being a jumping-off point for a larger conversation, at least in terms of the president's involvement.
Yeah. This is All Things Political. We're talking with Matt Grossman, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Michigan State University. We're going to move on from the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman trial and get back to the discussion on how productive or not our Congress has been this year. And for that, we'll go next to Eric in Marengo. Hi, Eric.
Hello. I need to challenge Professor Grossman's assertion that more legislative activity equals movement to the left. We have seen here in the state of Wisconsin nothing but moving to the right with our legislature. First of all, eviscerating the workers' rights for public employees. Second, the voter ID bills. Third, eviscerating our environmental protections with this stupid iron mine up here. And across the country, you can see right-wing legislators instituting ultrasound requirements, attacking women's health rights. So I don't see where he comes off with the statement that more legislative activity means moving to the left. I've seen quite the opposite.
It certainly doesn't equal it. And certainly there are some state-level examples that he mentioned that there's lots of activity that's moving policy to the right, and you also saw that after the Republican takeover of the U.S. Congress in 1994, we had one Congress where we had a lot of legislative activity, and most of it moved policy in a conservative direction. I'm just saying, overall, the correlation over time at the federal level, if you just count up the number of significant things that Congress achieves each two-year period, and then you count up the number of policies that move aggregate policy to the left, they're quite highly correlated, whereas if you do the same for conservative policy enactments, they don't seem to be. So conservatives don't seem to need real high levels of political activity to be associated with an aggregate conservative trend, whereas liberals, it seems to occur more often. But certainly, that's just been the trend at the federal level since 1945. It could be that we're seeing different trends at the state levels, or it could be that in the future we'll see a more activist government from the conservatives if, for example, they were to take over the Senate and the presidency.
So remind me how you're measuring that. Is it by the total number of bills passed, or what's your gauge for political activity?
Well, they are somewhat associated, but we actually try to look at the number of significant laws passed, and we do that by looking at year-end reviews or by looking at what historians believe are the most important laws passed over a long period of time. And all of those are quite closely associated, and they all show, for example, a big increase in liberal and a big increase in overall legislation in the 1960s and through the mid-1970s. And then, some different trends through there since then, including a large increase in both total activity and conservative activity in that 1994 Congress. But if you do it over the whole time period, there's a pretty big association between the amount that Congress is getting done of significance and the aggregate direction of policy moving to the left.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would speculate that regardless of party, there's going to be more activity when you have single-party control over both houses of a legislature or of Congress. Is that true?
Well, that's actually a huge debate within political science. There are some people who say yes, and there are others that say no, that we actually do tend to pass just as many things of significance in divided government as in unified government. But one thing that both sides agree on is that the agenda tends to expand during divided government. So what we have right now is the Republicans have a whole bunch of things on the agenda they want to pass. The Democrats have a whole bunch of things on the agenda they want to pass. And so in some sense, it may look like less is getting done in under divided government, but only because the agenda has expanded. But either way you look at it, today's Congress still looks lackluster in terms of the amount that it has been able to accomplish. So even considering divided government, this Congress has accomplished a lot less than others, and the previous one as well did.
What needs to change for them to become more cooperative and productive?
I mean, I think certainly party polarization is the big indicator that we're less likely to get major things accomplished. The Democrats are moving to the left, and the Republicans are moving to the right. The move among Republicans has been stronger and more consistent to the right. So that's what you're seeing in the Republican House caucus right now. But I would also say that high levels of government activity aren't necessarily the norm, even though we're at a low end. We had in the 40s and 50s, we had low polarization, and government still wasn't accomplishing that much on a yearly basis. So even though this latest era stands out, it's still the norm for significant legislation to be few and far between. And the Congress that we had when Obama took office and we had unified Democratic control was exceptional in the amount of new legislation and the breadth of that legislation.
1-800-642-1234 is the number to call if you have questions or comments for all things political. Our guest is Matt Grossman, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Michigan State University. And Mike in Madison, you're next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I think this Congress is going to be really remiss if it doesn't come up with something to reduce fossil fuel burning in the United States and our allies, et cetera. I think the subject of global warming is a major issue that's for everybody, regardless of party. And I think everybody who calls himself a Republican or Democrat ought to be calling their Congress people and telling them to do something significant in reducing this problem.
Okay, thanks, Mike. What do you think of that, Matt Grossman? The Congress should be focusing more on environmental issues.
Well, prospects look pretty bleak for a congressional approach to reduce fossil fuels, especially along the lines of cap and trade or a carbon tax. The president and the executive branch are moving forward on some proposals that they say will reduce carbon, especially at power plants. So there is some action in the executive branch. But you know, don't seem to be a political coalition on the Republican side to tackle that issue. One reason is that the sort of method in the past has sort of been to subsidize everything. That is, you get some of the green energy interests on board for subsidizing wind and solar, and then you get some of the fossil fuel industries on board for subsidizing fossil fuel production, and you put it together, and the loser is sort of the taxpayer who's subsidizing everything. But that coalition has sort of recently broken down, and you don't see a lot of support for that kind of initiative either.
Cindy and Superior. Hi, Cindy.
Oh, hi. Yes, my name is Cindy, and I just wanted to agree with the gentleman who called to say that he disagreed with the statement that if there are that more laws are passed under Democratic rule than Republican rule. I agreed with him because if you look at the legislature in a lot of the southern states where the Republicans are in control, they're passing lots and lots of legislature, including a lot of the legislature for anti-reproductive, for anti-laws that make it much more difficult for women and reproductive rights. And so, what happens is you get conservative Republicans in there, and they pass lots and lots of laws. And I don't think it makes any difference. It depends on who's in there. But I think the one thing I want to state is that, the Constitution states that the government is there for the people, by the people. And I think that what we've seen over the last 15 years is that it's been more government for the rich, which is the right-wing white people out there. So Pat Buchanan is white, and he's rich. And I think that's really what it's all about. It's all about having money, and it's really a shame to think that that all these anti-laws are, these laws are being passed that are really, it's really about keeping the poor poor.
Thank you, Cindy. Matt Grossman, I wanted to ask then, bouncing off of that point, has your research taken into account the involvement of special interest groups and whether they're impacting the number of laws that get passed or the amount of productivity in a legislative body?
Yes, but before I tackle that, I do want to respond to it real quickly that, first of all, I said again that I'm talking about the federal level and not state legislative level. Mm-hmm. And then I also didn't say that Republicans pass fewer laws than Democrats. What I said was when more laws are passed, they tend to move aggregate policy in a liberal direction at the national level. So, for example, when Republican President Richard Nixon was associated with a high level of legislative productivity, but most of those laws moved aggregate policy direction to the left rather than the right, and President Clinton's second term was associated with pretty unproductive policymaking, not many major laws passing Congress. And even though it was a Democratic president, it was overall fairly conservative lawmaking, at least by historical precedent. So one thing that might explain the recent state-level findings that might be consistent with the federal level is that we do find that when there's a new party takeover, we tend to see more overall activity. So, in North Carolina right now, you're seeing after the Republicans haven't controlled all of state government for a long time, and now they do, now they're passing a whole lot of laws. So independent of the overall association between liberalism and more legislative activity, there are some other associations, like whether a new party comes to power, that might also make a difference. In terms of the role of interest groups, if you certainly look at the aggregate trends, they would both show more interest groups and less lawmaking over time. But there isn't a whole lot of evidence that those two trends are connected. There is some more recent evidence at the state level that that lobbying activity is associated with bills being less lobbying activity against bills is associated with those bills being less likely to pass. So there is a little bit of evidence, but in terms of an explanation for the overall decline in legislative productivity, I think I'd look to something like party polarization long before looking at interest group lobbying.
Interesting. We're talking with Matt Grossman. He's an assistant professor of political science at Michigan State University and author of The Not-So-Special Interests, Interest Groups, Public Representation, and American Governance. We'd like to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Are you confident in the ability of Congress to pass laws and work together? We have a GOP-led House, a Democratic-led Senate, and, of course, Democratic president. And many are pointing to a lack of cooperation and party polarization for the lack of productivity. But perhaps this is what you think Congress should look like when it's under split political rule. After the break, we'll get into a political appointment to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That's right after this on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned next hour. Our guest explores ways to overcome imposter syndrome, which she defines as the fear and self-doubt that causes people to question their own abilities. That's 2 o'clock right here on the Ideas Network. I'm Cynthia Schuster, filling in for Kathleen Dunn, and this is All Things Political. Our guest this hour is Matt Grossman, assistant professor of political science at Michigan State University and author of The Not-So-Special Interests, Interest Groups, Public Representation, and American Governance. We'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org if you have any questions or thoughts about all things political. Well, last Tuesday, the Senate confirmed Richard Cordray as the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Cordray has been in charge of the agency ever since President Obama installed him through a recess appointment in 2011. And Matt Grossman, I'm wondering, to set this up, first tell us what the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau does. Why is this a significant appointment?
Well, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was created by the Dodd-Frank financial regulation bill that was passed in the wake of the financial crisis. And it's supposed to be the main agency charged with protecting consumers of financial products. And it's already been somewhat active in taking on some practices of banks and shadow financial institutions. And the reason that the appointment is significant, even though, as you said, it had already been made, is because a court had invalidated some of the president's previous recess appointments that were made in nearly identical fashion to the National Labor Relations Board. So there was concern that the decisions made by the Bureau wouldn't stand up to court scrutiny if there was no actual Senate confirmation of Cordray.
So what kind of things have the CFPB accomplished under Cordray's watch so far?
Well, I think credit card marketing practices have been a focus, and then there are other regulatory proceedings that are ongoing that aren't quite yet finished. But I think observers of it so far have been surprised at the willingness to pursue new regulations on banks and other shadow financial institutions.
And Republicans are a bit concerned about the power that the Bureau has. Can you explain what their concerns are?
Well, I mean, this appointment, for example, lasts, I believe, for 5 years, independent of, you know, if there was a new president, a new Republican president elected. Its funding is secure. From the Federal Reserve, so it is quite a bit more independent than previous financial regulators, and is empowered to essentially take on any practice that might be hurting consumers of financial products, which is basically everyone. So you know, that's an agency with a very wide purview.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Republicans also believe that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau should be headed by a 5-member commission, not a single director such as Cordray. What would it take to restructure it in that way?
I mean, I guess I would see that just as part of a wider effort to weaken the power of the agency somewhat, to make it less immediately able to act. Most Republicans were against it to start, and they at one point said that they wouldn't approve anyone's appointment to the board. So they didn't like its overall level of power. They don't like how independent it is from congressional oversight and funding. And so, you know, this is part of an effort to change all of that, but probably isn't going to make much progress, at least while Obama is still president.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Supreme Court says it's going to review whether Obama exceeded his constitutional authority when he made some of these recess appointments. If that happens, if they rule that he did, in fact, exceed his authority, what does that mean for the Bureau?
Well, I don't think it probably means much now that this Senate fight has been resolved. They would probably have to go back and redo some things that they had already done. The National Labor Relations Board appointments are also being replaced in this latest deal in the U.S. Senate. So those are the decisions that would be directly impacted by the litigation because it concerned actions that were taken by the NLRB under these recess appointments. So that would be the first thing that would take place. But even on those grounds, assuming that the replacement appointments go through, presumably the NLRB could just retake the decisions that they've already taken.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious from a political standpoint, as the Republicans kind of hem and haw over these appointments and their concerns over the structure of the Bureau, et cetera, would it be different if these individuals were being appointed under a Republican president? And do you think the Democrats would have the same concerns as the Republicans do today?
I mean, in general, the Democrats are going to have concerns about Republican appointments that they don't have right now, and vice versa. But in this particular case, I would say the concerns were really about the agency and opposition to the original financial regulation bill in the first place, opposition to creation of the agency, opposition to the agency's level of independence and power from Congress. So I think, you know, those are really concerns of Republicans rather than concerns of Democrats, and they're not just about Obama being the appointing authority.
Mm. We're talking with Matt Grossman. He is assistant professor of political science at Michigan State University and author of The Not-So-Special Interests, Interest Groups, Public Representation, and American Governance. This is All Things Political. We've been talking about a number of issues this week, including the political reaction to the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case, the productivity and lack thereof by our Congress in the United States Congress, and the appointment of Richard Cordray as the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. We're wondering what you think at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and you can also find us at the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. We'll go next to Bob in Waukesha. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wondered if your guest could comment on the role of congressional redistricting and gerrymandering, since he's been talking about increasing polarization. I know there was an editorial in Journal Sentinel over the weekend about pending legislation here in Wisconsin to try to turn over redistricting to a nonpartisan commission to try to depoliticize that whole process. And I wonder what your guest thinks about that and if that kind of thing makes sense across the country. And I could take my comments off the air.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Matt Grossman?
Yeah, so there is certainly some evidence that a partisan control of redistricting benefits that party, especially in the 2 or 4 year period after following the redistricting, and that these nonpartisan commissions would reduce that benefit to the party otherwise drawing the lines. But there is some evidence that the concerns might be somewhat overstated. One is that over the course of the decade between usual census redistrictings, you tend to see some less ability to predict that those seats are going to stay with the party that conducted the redistricting. So if the Republicans just did the redistricting, it should matter most in the last election and in 2014, and it should matter less in an election in 2018. And then the other piece of evidence that seems a little bit inconsistent with the redistricting-led story of congressional polarization is that there does seem to be just geographic sorting. Essentially, Democrats live in more concentrated areas. They live in cities. And as a result, even most lines drawn, for example, by computers also show Republicans more likely to win more seats than they win in total votes. So it could also be partially a consequence not just of partisan drawing of the lines, but of the fact that Democrats live in concentrated areas, and so any district that's controlled by the Democrats is likely to be overwhelmingly so compared to districts controlled by the Republicans.
Mm-hmm. So I guess given that the redistricting doesn't have as much importance 10 years down the road, let's say, what does that mean when it's time once again to reconsider those district lines?
Right. So each time we reconsider it, we expect then the biggest impact to be in, you know, the 2 or 4 years following it. But even if we have, say, the Republicans were in charge of the 2000 redistricting in a state, and then they were also in charge in 2010, we usually see an additional effect in 2010 and 2012 because, 2012 and 2014, because the lines they drew in 2000, you know, the demographics have changed somewhat since that time period, and so the additional partisan redistricting in 2010 still makes a little bit of a difference in the next 2 years. So what I'm saying is just the amount of time since the redistricting, the effects of that redistricting on that party gaining more support go down over time.
Gotcha. Well, we were talking about what Congress has and hasn't accomplished this year. They did pass 15 bills so far this year. Could you recap what some of those things were that made it through?
Well, I would say there was a couple of things that really made no difference. They were just commemorative. So the big ones that really did matter were at the very beginning of the year, the bill that increased taxes and had a lot of budget implications, and then the change to the FAA's treatment under the sequester that at least got rid of some of the problems that the FAA was having in making sure that there were enough air traffic controllers and other airport personnel to handle airline traffic. So not a long list of important initiatives.
When you said commemorative measures, I was thinking about, I think I read that one of them was regarding commemorative coins. Is that right?
Yeah. So, you know, one of Boehner's defenses is, well, it's not our role to, you know, pass a bunch of commemorative laws. And that's true. But even if you get rid of those, it still looks like this Congress and the previous Congress are much less productive than Congresses have been in the past. But the propensity for most bills that pass to be insignificant is the reason why political scientists tend to use these measures of significant laws that mm-hmm. pass rather than just you know, any number of bills passed. The other big trend, there is a trend over time where more and more things are getting grouped together. So if you think about it, if the Republicans' proposal on immigration were to pass, that would result in, you know, 6 or 7 bills because they want to split the same bill up into 6 or 7 parts, whereas the Senate Democratic bill is one bill. So the other complication with just counting bills is that, you know, you don't want to count the 7 Republican bills that would be equivalent to the 1 Senate bill as 7 times as important.
Yeah. Well,
but anyway you look at it, productivity is down.
Well, one thing that did happen was sequestration, and also student loan interest rates have gone up on account of the Senate's inability to reach a deal on that front. But it seems like there's a trend toward putting things off, or at least not reaching resolution, but doing so under the threat that if we don't reach a resolution, an even worse outcome might result. Is that an effective approach? Is that really inspiring our representatives to work together and reach a compromise?
Well, you know, brinksmanship until the deadline has a very long history, but certainly we did see a damaging episode in the bill that gave us the sequester in 2010. So the trend isn't a good one, although it is part of a you know, more perennial political process of putting things off till the last minute until you're forced to move. So we'll have a few more of those in the fall when the debt ceiling expires and the current budgets need to be redone or extended. So brinksmanship is here to stay.
Well, in our last 30 seconds here, what should we be looking out for? What are people going to be talking about come Friday?
Well, of course, I'm in Michigan, so we're very focused on the Detroit bankruptcy and the implications for the state and the nation. So I think there'll be a lot of talk about that this week.
Great. Well, Matt Grossman, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Matt Grossman is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Michigan State University and author of the Not-So-Special Interests, Interest Groups, Public Representation, and American Governance. KP Whaley and Rhonda Fanning produced this hour. I'm Cynthia Schuster.